At 3:30, Bill Van Wert will be reviewing the re-release with extra footage of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. At about 4 o'clock, a short interview with Mel Torme, and at 4:15, Dave Brubeck will tell us about his career. With me now on Fresh Air is Ann Rule, who's going to tell us about a very bizarre coincidence. A former detective, Ann Rule had been writing up unsolved crime cases for True Detective magazine. Eventually, she was assigned a major story about a still unidentified murderer who took the lives of over a dozen young women after committing sexual assaults. As she accumulated the story, evidence she came across led her to think that the murderer was a young man she once worked with by the name of Ted Bundy. Ironically, they worked together at a suicide prevention center. At approximately the same time that Ann Rule became suspicious of Bundy, his lover also presented incriminating evidence to the police, which led to his arrest. Ann has told the story of Ted Bundy and the story of her astonishment and horror at the revelation of his identity in a new book, which is called The Stranger Beside Me. The book is published by Norton. Ann, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I'd like you to describe your impressions of Ted Bundy when you knew him as a college student when you were both at this suicide prevention center working together.
That takes us back to 1971, and we worked the late night shift every Tuesday for a year together. I was a volunteer, and Ted was working to put himself through school. He was an honor student in deviant psychology at the university, and I was a crime writer. And there are a dozen years difference between our ages, but we established an immediate rapport. One of the most charming, intelligent, empathetic, sympathetic young man I had ever known. And for years, there was nothing about that image that was tarnished for me.
He didn't seem like a potential murderer.
No way. No way.
How did you become involved with writing the story of the murderer who turned out to be your colleague?
Well, I have been, for the last 12 years, I cover the Northwest for True Detective magazine and four other fact detective magazines, and the New York Daily News and the Chicago Tribune. So that takes me down to homicide headquarters at least one day a week. And I am aware of what's going on, usually in police circles. I can't talk about it to anybody else, and I don't write about it. But the pattern of murders began in January of 1974. We didn't know they were murders then, but we thought they were. Between January and July, 8 young women disappeared in the Northwest under circumstances that were almost unbelievable. They were seen near people, and then they were gone. No trace of them and no physical evidence left by a killer. So at that time, I thought it would be sometime maybe an interesting book. And I had my contract from W.W. Norton written with the understanding that there would be no book unless at some date somebody would be arrested and convicted. And truly, at that time, the disappearances were so bizarre, I suspected a cult rather than one person. And certainly I didn't suspect Ted Bundy. Ted Bundy had gone on to become assistant director of the Seattle Crime Prevention Advisory Board. He had worked as a psychiatric social worker at the county hospital where he made up plans for patients, medication recommendations for patients, and even was assistant to Governor Dan Evans in the Evans for re-election campaign, a position pretty high up where he was reporting directly to the governor. So, of course, he was beyond what I knew about him. He would be the last person to be suspected.
Now, as you were trying to piece together this story, mm-hmm. you found some evidence that made you think of him. What were some of those
things?
Well,
at the time, I felt so guilty. The last two girls to disappear went the same day, July 14th, 1974. It was a beautiful Sunday afternoon. And at Lake Sammamish State Park, there were 40,000 people there that day, including the Seattle Police Guild picnic. And a young man who introduced himself in the hearing of other people on the beach as Ted was seen approaching one of the victims. And they said he had a slight Canadian accent. They described him. He wore a white tennis outfit, talked of playing racquetball. And a couple girls, he had his arm in a sling, which is a vital thing in this case. A couple of girls went as far as the car with him. He wanted help getting his boat on the car. And then something just, they didn't want to go. Because he kept saying, well, the boat isn't here. We've got to go up the hill to my parents' house. Well, a composite picture was drawn up by a police artist. And I looked at that picture. For 3 weeks, I kept looking at that picture, and it did resemble Ted Bundy, who I knew. And I knew he lived within half a mile of three of the girls who disappeared. And I knew he played racquetball. And I knew he had a funny accent that sounded somewhat Canadian. So I wrestled with my conscience, and I finally went to a good friend in the homicide unit. And I said, I don't think Ted has a car, because I have always given him rides to parties because he didn't have a car. But it's bothering me enough. I just want you to put him on the computer so that I can know it isn't him, because I know he doesn't have a car. Well, of course, we were looking for a 1968 bronze Volkswagen. And 20 minutes later, my friend called back and said, would you believe a bronze Volkswagen, 1968? And I thought he was kidding me, because he's a tease. And he said, no, it's registered to Theodore Robert Bundy. Well, actually, all that came of that at that time is it was put into the hopper with 3,000 other suspects. And what they were doing, they were trying to winnow out possibles, probables. And here they look at Ted Bundy. He's on the Seattle Crime Prevention Commission. You know, he's in with the governor. Nothing else. So I didn't hear anything about it for 14 months, and I didn't worry about it anymore because I thought, well, I'm just like every other hysterical woman running in with a possible Ted.
It's interesting how guilty
terribly
you felt
guilty,
about it.
Because this was my friend, and you don't turn in your friend.
Now, when he was arrested, you thought that it was your evidence that incriminated
yes.
him, but it turned out to actually be his lover's
yeah.
story that got him put in prison.
At the same time, I was worrying his girlfriend, Meg, who he had lived with for 6 years off and on, and she really loved him, but she had found things that really bothered her, like a crowbar, a machete, plaster of Paris, crutches, women's underwear, not hers, many things that made her begin to worry, and she checked her diary and her check register, and she realized he had never been with her on the at the times the girls disappeared. So she reported it to the police, both in Washington and in Utah, but even so, without physical evidence, all the things she'd seen were long gone, you can't run out and arrest a man. So the reason he was caught, 14 months later, he was cruising in his Volkswagen with the lights off in Salt Lake City and happened to pass the home of a sergeant in the Utah Highway Patrol. And the guy knew everybody in his neighborhood, and he thought, what's this Volkswagen with no lights doing on? So he just pulled away from the curb and was signaled for the Volkswagen to pull over. Instead, it rabbited, and he chased it about half a mile. When he stopped the car, inside was Ted Bundy, dressed in cat burglar clothes. That's, you know, the black turtleneck T-shirt, the sneakers. And he had a bag containing a pantyhose mask, handcuffs, all manner of burglar tools, and a few other things that seemed to link him to an unsolved abortive kidnapping case that had happened the year before.
As a crime reporter on this, it was your job to try to look at patterns,
right,
find patterns,
right,
and describe them. What were some of the patterns that you found in his method? And as someone who knew Ted Bundy, did any of those patterns coincide with what you knew about him as an individual?
Well, the main pattern in the method of the Ted, in quotes, was to use some device to throw women off guard. Sometimes he used a full leg cast. Sometimes he used his arm in a sling or in a cast, his finger in a cast. Sometimes he used the badge of a fireman, sometimes the badge of a policeman. Now, that certainly didn't tie into anything I knew about Ted Bundy, but I think I'm a cautious woman because of what I write, and I'm sure you're cautious. But most of us, if we see a young man who smiles ingratiatingly, and that is Ted Bundy, who the facade is of such charm, and if he came up to me and said, hey, I'm having trouble with my arm. I can't hold my books. They keep dropping. I can't get my boat on my car. I would have gone. And the girls who went were not easy pickups. It wasn't a matter of that. They were girls who had trained to do, to work with retarded children, to be a doctor, service occupations. One was a psychiatric social worker herself, and no dummy. But they went with him quietly. There was no screaming. And this would go along, in retrospect, with the charm of the man I knew, the little boy quality.
I also got the impression that the people who he chose as his victims were people who physically and in demeanor resembled the lover who you explained after living with him on and off for 6 years.
That's a different lover. There were two of them. Ted has always had two women at once, even inside the walls. Meg is the girl who turned him in. Stephanie is the girl who obsessed him. And Ted was always attracted to rich, beautiful, not nouveau riche, but long-established rich families. And he met Stephanie in 1968 when he was about 19 or 20. And they had a year-long affair. And he was totally in love with her, or I don't think he understands love as we know it, but attached to her, possessed with her. And she rejected him. She went home to California. She wanted someone from her world. So Ted set about grooming himself for 4 years. This is during this time he graduated with distinction and all the other things I told you about, the being up in the Republican Party with the car, the credit cards, the prestige. He went to California 4 years later, and he re-wooed Stephanie. This time she fell desperately in love with him. She couldn't believe the change. She agreed to marry him. She came up to Seattle to visit him, to make marriage plans. She was going to work to put him through college, and he dumped her. And she couldn't believe what had happened. Several months later, she figured out that he had won her back just so he could reject her as she had rejected him. But evidently, that revenge didn't make him feel any better, because it was 3 days after he sent her away in 1974, just after Christmas 73, that he attacked the first woman. And the women all resemble Stephanie, some of them almost identical.
Do you see the crimes that he committed as being attached to revenge towards her? Do you think that his very bizarre reaction to her was just a function of the same psychosis that was motivating his behavior patterns?
I think you're right in the second thing that you're saying, because I have traced back a couple of murders that happened back in 62, 66. I think he was a sociopath, probably from the time he was a little boy, and the way he dealt with her was the way a sociopath would.
What's a sociopath?
The term changes. It's truly an antisocial personality, not legally psychotic. It's a personality disorder wherein there is no conscience. It's like, I'm okay, you're not okay, therefore whatever I do to you to make me feel better is fine. And no empathy, but the ability to mimic and present the facade that they learn the world wants to get what they want.
You quote an Augusta psychiatrist who interviewed him before his Miami trial,
yes.
And I'll just quote that here. Yeah. The psychiatrist said, the observer is confronted with a convincing mask of sanity, but we're dealing not with a complete man at all, but with something that suggests a subtly constructed reflex machine which can mimic the human personality perfectly.
And it's terrifying, isn't it? But I think that's what Ted Bundy was and is.
Did you feel like a sucker?
Yes, but I don't feel embarrassed about it, because I'm in good company. Many top lawyers, many top psychology professors at the University of Washington raved about Ted Bundy. Governor Dan Evans wrote a letter of recommendation to the Utah Law School for Ted Bundy, in it saying somewhat ironically, if you accept Ted Bundy, you'll be getting a very unusual man. Well, they did, and they were, but not in the sense that Governor Evans had meant at the time.
After he was initially arrested and after you had pretty well figured out mm-hmm. that it was him, you met with him a couple of times for some wine and dinner and had long talks with him. One of the questions you asked him very straightforwardly, I thought, was, Ted, do you hate women? In the context of the fact that he not only killed women, but mm-hmm. he committed sexual mm-hmm. assaults against them. And he said, he thought about it and said, no, I don't think so.
No, I said it the other way. I said, Ted,
do you like women? Right.
Because I was tippy-toeing because you don't look at a good friend and say, hey, did you kill those eight girls last year?
Of course, you know. Of course.
And, yeah, he did think about it. He said, yes, I think so.
Yes, I think
and,
I like that.
Yeah, and I and his mother, see, Ted was illegitimate. The family was from Philadelphia. And when his mother became pregnant in 1946, she went to Vermont, gave birth in an unwed mother's home, brought him back here to Philadelphia, and began a lie, a tragic lie, but out of love, pretending she was his older sister and his grandparents were his parents. And then she took him away when he was four, way out to Washington, married his stepfather. So his whole life, he knew about the lie, but this is what he told me, but he couldn't say anything to anybody. I think this is one of the things that bothered him. And when we were talking that day, I asked him again. I said, you know, your mother may have lied to you, but she must have really loved you because she could have let you go, and she kept you the only way she knew how. And he said, yes, I think I can understand that.
Do you think that he hated women?
I think one place in the book I say we're both a comfort and a curse to him because he can manipulate us, but when we don't do what he wants, then he's outraged. And we have a certain power over him, probably from the earliest time, the little boy whose mother didn't tell him the truth. And I don't want to fault the mother because she's been through hell. And I'm a mother of four myself, and mistakes happen, and sometimes it's not the mother's fault. But I don't know. I don't think he hated women. I think we have a strange fascination for him. But he can't put a label on us, or he can't tie us. Well, literally, he did tie some of us up.
You must have. I mean, I think everyone asks themselves the question: what kind of person could possibly commit sexual assaults and murder? Mm-hmm. What kind of person does it take to do that? And you describe in your book how after a couple of the murders, he called one of his lovers up and said, "You want to get some dinner?" And they went out to dinner, all this being, of course, completely
that was
unknown to his lover, right?
Yeah, and all she could remember of that day is he was exhausted, and that was the day that we must believe he killed two girls.
So did you ask yourself this question, what kind of person could do that, and come up with anything that helped make sense of it?
I've asked myself that question over and over because I've written 900 full-length fact detective stories, and probably 100 of them were about rapists. And contrary to popular opinion, some of the rapists I've written about are the best-looking men I've ever seen in my life. And any lady would probably say yes willingly. So it's a person with rage that cannot be contained. And you know that rape is not a sexual crime. It's a crime of intense anger, and it's a way to humiliate and demean women. And so I think Ted's fear of women plus his need for women was a constant dichotomy. And I think that sparked what happened.
By the time his last trial was held, I think early in 1980 in Florida, mm-hmm. he had become, I guess in the world of crime, a pretty well-known figure.
Yes.
And the press was there. A lot of the public showed up for the mm-hmm. trial. What did you think of the way the trial was handled by the media and the attitude that the people who came to watch the trial had?
Well, I went not to this last trial. I went to the big media circus, and that was in Miami just about a year ago in July 1979. Interestingly enough, none of us went back to the trial this year unless we were ordered to, because It was too hard on all of us. But it was something of a circus. And in the beginning, Ted loved it. He called me the week before, and he said, with a combination of Ted Bundy and the Kyle Mega murders, I'm going to be in the limelight for a long, long time. And he said it with pride. And then he said, now, if you have any trouble getting in, you come to me. I'm the golden boy. I can have anything I want. If I want somebody in the courtroom, they'll be in the courtroom. So when I got down there, it was pandemonium. People lined up to get into the courtroom. I listened to the spectators and the things they said about Ted Bundy and what should be done to him. Now, this is outside the courtroom, and there were four-letter words, which I cannot repeat here. And I turned around, and they were nice grandmothers, nice grandfathers. We had to be, every time we went in or out of the courtroom, we had to go through metal detectors for fear someone would try to kill him in the courtroom. The most astounding thing, shouldn't have been because I've known of the phenomenon before, but every murderer with much publicity has groupies. And there were more Ted groupies than you've ever seen in the whole front row behind the table where he sat, say 25 young women, beautiful between 16 and 23 maybe, the ages of his victims, and he would often turn around and flash that grin and they'd giggle as if Elvis Presley himself were there.
That's very peculiar.
To some women, that's the ultimate macho thing.
What were your feelings about the death penalty before and after your encounter with this case?
This is where I come smack up against myself. I started out as a social worker, didn't believe in the death penalty at all. Then after 12, 13 years of writing fact detective stories, I found myself writing about the same people I wrote about 10 or 12 years ago, murderers who got life, which in Washington, Oregon means 12 years, 13 years. They're perfect prisoners. They get out and they do it again immediately. So I was doing reruns. I also have joined a group of the victims' families. So I do believe in the death penalty, absolutely, for certain types of crimes. Not crimes of passion where a guy finds somebody with his wife, but this type of crime that we're talking about. And yet, and I'm sure they're going to kill Ted Bundy, but in my mind, I still cannot completely erase the young man that I thought I knew back then, who probably didn't even exist then, and the friendship that he showed me, and he gave me some good advice. I was going through a very difficult divorce. So at the time that he is killed, it will be a very traumatic thing for me. I would prefer, and I don't think this is just because I knew him, this man is such a classic sociopath, I think he should be studied. And we might get some clues. There are a lot of little sociopaths growing up now. If we could get some clues, whether it's chromosomal or environment, genetic, whatever, we might save a lot of victims 20 years from now of would-be Ted Bundys.
How has your affiliation with this murder case and knowing that you are close to someone who turns out to be a sociopath,
right,
a murderer, has it made you more fearful of meeting new people or of walking the streets, or do you find you're always second-guessing yourself when you make evaluations of people?
No, there's a certain loss of innocence because I thought that I knew people's character. But basically, I believe well of people. This case hasn't changed me any more than writing all the other detective stories. I would never hitchhike. I would never let my daughters hitchhike. I would never get in my car without looking in the back seat. And now on the tour of cities, I won't go walking at night because I don't know which areas of town are safe. So normal caution. But if I were to allow this one really close encounter with a sociopath to warp me, I would never trust anybody again, and that's not part of my character.
I just want to get back to the con that he used to get women to come with him. Again, he'd put his arm in a sling and try to be balancing a pile of things or say that he had something he had to load into his car. He couldn't manage it. Can you come and help me? And you talk about how a couple of women who initially started to help him saw the car and saw that the passenger seat of the car was missing and felt that there was something so mysterious and evil about the car that they just ran.
Yeah, they got vibrations, which ordinarily, I mean, you can see a car without a seat and that wouldn't do anything, but these girls just got chills and it saved their lives.
No, it's funny, but I think many women have, and many men too, have experienced the feeling of sitting next to, for instance, on the train, mm-hmm. someone who you feel is like really distrustful,
right.
possibly
right.
intending harm to
right.
you. And this may be particularly with women, I don't know, you feel, well, but I don't want to embarrass them or make them feel bad mm-hmm. by getting up and leaving.
Yeah.
and it's such a strange thing. Here you are feeling like maybe your life is endangered, mm-hmm. but you don't want to embarrass the guy by walking up and leaving. Have you encountered that experience?
Yes, I have.
Or you wouldn't run away from someone who you feel might really be malicious because they haven't really pulled out a knife and proven that they want to assault you yet.
I think that you shouldn't. It's happened to me, and I've gotten up and left. Your life is more important, and if mothers are listening or daughters are listening, your life is so much more important than taking any chances at all. And it doesn't always happen to somebody else. My hope is if one girl is saved because of reading this book, then the book will be worth having written.
How has the whole experience changed the course of your life?
Not a whole lot. I'm thrilled to have written a book. It's going to be a Book of the Month Club selection. I'm thrilled to be taking this tour. I'm not blasé about it because it's once-in-a-lifetime thing. But there's another part of it. I always wanted to write a book wherein I explored a crime and the criminal in complete detail. And it's sort of like, be careful what you wish for because you just might get it. And you do get it, but not the way you wanted it to be. And I have the book, but a man who I thought was going to be a real boon to humanity has emerged as a monster. So the success is fraught with remorse, too.
Well, as a writer, it's a great opportunity because you get to look at this person up close and you get to be a crime writer, but you and also get to be very much within the book. So it gives you the perfect opportunity to put yourself in the story without having to worry about objectivity.
I didn't mean to put myself in the story and I sat down and tried to write it straight.
Oh, you'd have to be
omniscient,
wouldn't you?
And I couldn't do it because I didn't just research this book. I lived it for the last 6 years and I can't take Ann Rule out of it.
Well, it's an amazing story, and I want to thank you very much for coming and telling us the story
thank
on
you.
Fresh Air.
Tell him the title one more time.
I will. My guest is Ann Rule, and let me just recap the story. If you tune in the middle, you might be a little confused. Like in the early 70s, Ann, who was a freelance crime writer, was also volunteering at a suicide prevention center, and there she worked with someone by the name of Ted Bundy, who helped out on the phones, discouraging people who were thinking of committing suicide. Years later, she was working on the story of an unsolved series of murderers, and the mass murderer turned out to be this same Ted Bundy who she had once worked with at this crisis center. So she's written the story both of his life, of his crimes, and also of where she fits into all of it and what it was like for her to reveal this evidence incriminating a former colleague. Her book is called The Stranger Beside Me, and it was just published by Norton.